How many of you have taken a ride in a hot air balloon? I see your hands if you've been up in a hot air balloon. One, two, three, four. Michael, you didn't go? He didn't go. Okay, four people. I can't raise my hand either. For 10 years, I have wanted to go. Ever since I've been living here and watched those balloons, I mean, every day I see those balloons going up over Del Mar. And I've said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it someday. This morning I called my son, woke him up at college. Kids always love that when their parents call early in the morning and wake them up at college. But I said, son, when you were doing your crewing for the balloon company in Del Mar, making money, did you ever get to ride? And he says, no. He says, I just worked on as the ground crew, part of the ground crew. So apparently he hasn't done it either. And the thing that triggered this is that I heard a very interesting story from a preacher this week, or actually a couple weeks ago. Apparently, his wife gave him a unique birthday present. It was a ride in a hot air balloon. So they went out to the field where they heat the things up, and get them ready to go. And they met the other couple that was going to go with them and exchanged pleasantries as much as you do when you're meeting a couple you won't see again. And it's just like, my name is so and so. What's your name? What do you do for a living? What are you, you know, I mean. And they got in the balloon and they began their ascent. It was beautiful. Quoting, it was scenic. This was Southern California. And we could look out over the hills and see all the way to the ocean. It was a majestic sight. I was inspired and excited. But I experienced one other emotion I hadn't anticipated. Fear. The balloon basket went up about knee-high. One good lurch and you'd be right out of there. Now, I asked my son about that. He says, Dad, he says, something's crazy. He says, the baskets I were working, they came up to hitch you about the waist. And he said, if it was only knee high, they couldn't even get insurance for that. It couldn't be a commercial operation. It must have been a private balloon or something. Or the other thing I thought of afterwards, this guy may have been very tall. He may have been very tall. Very scared. Like, Tim, how tall are you? 6'4". Okay, and there was a guy at first service, 6'5". And you get up tall enough, and I guess where it hits the rest of us at the waist, it would hit them about knee-high. I don't know, Michael Jordan, probably he would hit him about knee-high. Okay, one good lurch and you'd be right out of there. My palms were sweating, my heart was pounding, and I was gripping the ropes, and I thought I was the most frightened person in the basket until I looked over at my wife. I decided that I would like to get to know something about the guy who was flying the balloon. I could have tried to psych myself up into thinking everything was just going to work out great. I could have tried to cultivate a positive mental attitude and say, I believe, I believe, I believe. But, we'd placed ourselves in this guy's hands, our destiny's hands, and our lives rested on his competence and his character. So I inched over towards him and asked, what do you do for a living? How'd you get started flying balloons? I was hoping he would say something like he was a neurosurgeon and that he had started flying hot air balloons because he used to be an astronaut and missed flying. I knew that we were in trouble when his response began was with, well, it's like this, dude. He didn't actually have a job. He said mostly he served. It's okay, it's Southern California. He said he began flying hot air balloons after he was driving his pickup truck and had too much to drink. And he'd gotten into a rather bad accident. And he'd injured his brother, who was no longer able to get along too well. And so he started flying hot air balloons to give his brother something to watch. And then he said, if when we start to descend, the descent is rather bumpy, it's because I've never flown this particular balloon before. I'm not sure how we're going to quite get it down, how it's going to go. My wife looked at me and said, you mean we're 1,000 feet up in the air with an unemployed surfer who started flying hot air balloons because he was driving his pickup truck and got drunk and crashed it and crippled his brother and he's never been in this balloon before and he doesn't know how to get it down? The other couple had not spoken a word the whole flight. And now the wife of the other couple speaks for the only time during the journey, and she said to me, you're a pastor, do something religious. So I took up an offering. And he said, everything but the last was true. Wow. What an illustration to me. The big question is, can I trust the pilot? We live on this giant balloon that's spinning through space around the sun. And I wake up every once in a while and wonder, is anybody flying this thing? Is there somebody in control? And can that somebody be trusted? You know, you can play games with yourself. I know for a long time I just tried to repress questions I didn't want to face. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Okay, I won't think about it. I won't think about it, you know? Or you can just chant, I believe, I believe. You can try to put your faith in faith. If I believe hard enough, it's all going to work. But the real question is anybody flying this thing? Can the pilot be trusted? Are his character and his competence such that I can place myself in his hands and know that it's going to be okay? I'm talking today about faith. And this story illustrates to me how closely faith is connected to risk. You don't have faith unless there's some risk involved. You don't have risk without some fear. And you don't have that without some failure occasionally. So what I'm really studying with you today is the concept of a fear-filled faith. Matthew chapter 14. Would you open the Word with me to 10:52, Matthew the 14th chapter. And if you could give me just a little more sound, Chris, at the board, just turn me up just a little bit. Matthew chapter 14. Reading beginning with verse number 22. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side. After, while he dismissed the crowd, after he dismissed them, he went up into the hills by himself to pray, and when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves, because the wind was against it. The wind was against it. Now, picture here, we're talking seasoned sailors. These fishermen, these guys are no strangers to boats. They're used to doing this sort of thing. Mark's picture of this particular sequence says that they were straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Big, tough, seasoned fishermen. Verse 25. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them. The Romans divided the night into four watches, 6 to 9, 9 to 12, 12 to 3, 3 to 6. Fourth watch of the night, we're talking 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. That's sleepy time, folks, right? 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. during the fourth watch of the night. Jesus went out to them doing what? Walking on the lake. Thank you. That's right. Walking on the lake. And it says, when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were what? They were absolutely terrified. It's a ghost, they said. And they cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, eight words that you may be in a special spot in your life right now and need to hear. These eight words, mark them down carefully. Here we are. Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. Now, I want you to just picture this scene. I want you to picture the size of the waves. How high are they? How big of waves have you been in? I mean, are we going to make these 3-footers or 8-feet waves?
10-feet
waves. 10 feet? Brother, let's not make this a tidal wave exactly. I mean, picture the size of the waves. Picture the darkness of the night. Feel the force of the wind. Hear the howling sound of the wind. Picture this little boat struggling to stay afloat. It's being buffeted. The Greek word has the actual meaning of tormented, tormented by the wind and the waves. The disciples are cold, they're wet, they're exhausted, they're terrified. And it is in this particular setting that Peter is going to get out of the boat. You know, I was trying to identify with that this week, and the thought that came to my mind was water skiing, Terry. Now, when we go out water skiing, and we've done it a couple times, I like to have this guy driving the boat, because he's very compassionate and kind and and a dependable boat driver. You can count on his driving the boat. He's going to take care of you. But there's something I've noticed about water skiing, and maybe it's just me, but when I go water skiing, I like for everything to be just right. I don't want it to be at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't want it to be dark. I don't want the wind to be blowing. I don't want there to even be any chop. I want it to be glassy smooth. I don't like it when the water's too cold. You know, I want the conditions just right. And even when the conditions just right, when we get out there and they say, okay, Jerry, it's your turn, jump out. There's this little feeling inside of me. And you know what I think it is? Fear. Now, I look at Terry and I'm sure he never has this, because he is absolutely invincible as a skier. But I will confess to you that I am afraid. I'm afraid every time I get out of that boat and get in that water. And I think to myself, and Peter, you did this at what time? You got out of this boat at 3 o'clock in the morning with the wind blowing, absolutely dark, and there was a storm and the boat was about to sink, and you see this person walking to you on the water, and you get out of the boat in that particular setting? I mean, this is absolutely incredible to me. I mean, and then what happens? Peter fails. He begins to sink. And so all my life, I have heard this story, I have studied it, and I have recognized that this is a story of Peter's failure. But is it really? Think about it. Have you ever failed at anything? Have you ever failed a test? You have? Ever fail to get a job that you applied for? Ever fail to get a promotion? Ever fail to keep a marriage together that you thought you could do? Ever been impatient with a 3-year-old? Ever eaten with the wrong fork? Ever worn synthetic fibers? I mean, you think it through. And I imagine that every single one of us could raise our hands and say, yeah, boy. And perhaps you can even go back to childhood and you can remember a time when you failed and other people laughed and made fun of you. And maybe it's something that you've even carried for years. A lot of us struggle with that, because kids are merciless to each other, aren't they, many times? I mean, it's just absolutely awesome. Yeah. Failure. Any kind. Now, all of us are would-be water walkers, but the problem that we face in life is that the boat is safe. The boat is comfortable. It's secure, and the waves are rough, and the water is high, and the wind is strong, and the night is dark, and there is a storm out there, and if you get out of the boat, you may sink. But if you don't get out of the boat, you'll never walk on the water. If you want to walk on the water, there's absolutely one essential step, and that is to get out of the boat. You've got to do it. I discovered the same thing about water skiing. I cannot ski from inside the boat. It just doesn't work that way. And there is something, there is someone, I would prefer to say, inside of us who is telling us that our lives are about more than just sitting in the boat. And that someone is calling us to leave the routines of our comfort levels, our comfort zones, our security positions and postures, and is telling us to go for it, to really become fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. You know, as we've been going through our seven-step strategy and picturing what a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ is like, I have felt within myself a stirring to say, Lord, that's what I want to be. I want to become that. And I've heard that from you folks too. What does that mean? What does that mean? It's the middle of the night. Jesus goes to his disciples. They see him walking on the water. They're terrified. He speaks these eight wonderful words. Don't be afraid. Take courage. It is I. You can trust me. I'm piloting this thing. You can rely upon me. You have the storm. You have me. Who's more powerful? Matthew chapter 14, verse number 28. Lord, if it's you, and there's that word if that I find myself using all the time. Lord, if it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Come, he said. And then Peter got down out of the boat. Boy, I wish I could have seen that. I wonder what he did. He swung one leg over the edge of the boat. And how did that work? He puts the foot down on the water, and he must have started to put some weight down on that foot, and then brought the other leg outside of the boat. And then, for just a moment, he must have done something that no other mortal person has ever done. Literally, walk on water. Yeah, incredible. It's absolutely incredible for just a moment. For just a moment, it's just Peter and Jesus standing there on the water. What does it say? Then Peter got down out of the boat and he did what? He walked on the water to Jesus. Now, all the time I thought this was just a story of failure, but I want you to notice something that I've just discovered in this text. He walked on the water to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he did what? He cried out. He cried out. Now, I'd like to ask you a question. Did Peter fail? Well, in one sense, yes, he failed. But in another sense, I think this story radically redefines failure for a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ. Failure is not so much an event as it is the way we view an event. For example, we've all heard of Jonas Salk, the inventor of the vaccine for polio. Someone asked him one time, apparently he had 200 unsuccessful formulas for vaccinations that didn't work before he came up with the right one. So somebody asked him, he said, how did it feel to fail 200 times trying to invent a vaccine for polio? And here was his reply. He says, I never failed 200 times at anything in my life. My family taught me never to use that word. I simply discovered 200 ways how not to make a vaccine for polio. What is failure anyway? Or somebody asked Winston Churchill, what most prepared you to lead Great Britain through World War II? And you'd be shocked at his reply, because here's the man, you know, Great Britain for quite a while stood alone against Nazi Germany. I mean, we came into the war, but much later, you know, I mean, for a while, it was just Great Britain. Yeah. And you know what he said? It was the time I repeated a class in grade school. And the questioner said to him, you mean you flunked a grade? You, Winston Churchill, flunked a grade? No, I never flunked in my life. I was given a second chance to get it right. Did Peter fail? Well, in one sense, his faith gave way. He lost his focus upon Jesus. He sank. He failed. But here's the part that's new for me about this story. There were 11 bigger failures back in the boat. They failed privately. They failed quietly. They were safe, unnoticed, uncriticized. Only Peter experienced the shame of the public, you know, out front failure. But only Peter knew the glory of walking on the water with Jesus, even for a short time. Only Peter knew firsthand, from firsthand experience, something that the others would only be able to hear him tell about. And that is that when he sank, Jesus was there able to save him. Only Peter had that moment of shared connection with Jesus that the others never had because they didn't get out of the boat. They didn't get out of the boat. Think about it. What does it mean to get out of the boat? Maybe you're thinking you'd like to and you're not sure. What in the world? What are the implications of this for me? Boy, Roger, I love your honesty. When a person gets up in front of church, as the head of the church, and says, you know, this is a problem for me. I struggle with this. I'd say we need more of that kind of honesty in church, don't we? Thank you. I appreciate that, and I praise God for it. What does it mean to get out of the boat? What does it mean to get out of the boat? Well, the first thing I think it means, the key to the whole thing, is a choice, a decision. It's a decision that one makes to become a fully devoted follower of Jesus. It's not saying, oh, I believe in the 27 fundamentals that were voted in Dallas in 1980. That's not necessarily getting out of the boat. Or, I think I'm going to be able to pass the test at the pearly gates with biblical knowledge because I took Bible 17 years in grade school and academy or whatever. That's not what it means, getting out of the boat. What it means to get out of the boat is it is my ultimate goal to live the way that Jesus would live if he were in my body. That's my ultimate goal. A person who is not a fully devoted follower, who hasn't gotten out of the boat, is someone who has any other goal. Any other goal. Could be a good one. It's just some other goal. And this isn't something that you drift into. You know, this picture that's on the front of the bulletin, our mission to turn non-Christian people into fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. In the seven-step strategy, fully devoted followers build intentional relationships of integrity with non-Christians, share sensitive verbal testimony as God provides opportunity, invite seekers to a service. Seekers come to belief in God and commit to worship Him, participate in small groups, serve in the body, and manage life's resources for God. You know, what is that? That's a picture of someone who's really gotten out of the boat, isn't it? Somebody who's gotten out of the boat, a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ. The Stevens Ministry series, Kathy, that I am so excited about, we have three individuals in our church that have gone through the two-week training course for Stevens Ministry, Kathy Staniford, Stan Valentine, and Ron Marlin. And they are our Stevens Ministry leaders. 25 individuals now have gone through or are going through the Caring Evangelism class. And many of these will be looking forward to becoming Stephen ministers in the fall when we begin training Stephen ministers. That to me is the doorway, the Caring Evangelism class, the doorway to this whole ministry area that means getting out of the boat for the body, people in the body of Christ, getting out of the boat, taking that step. And I would just like to thank you, Kathy, and others who are involved in that process. I think it is absolutely vital if we're going to make it. It has to be a choice. You don't just kind of drift out of the boat. You have to make a decision. As a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ, what does this mean? Well, it means different things to different people because of what you need to learn. I think of one seamstress who decided to get out of the boat. She was a member of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. It was December of 1955, and a bus driver told her to give up her seat because she was a black American, African American, and a white person needed her seat. And she refused to do that. And by taking that courageous stand, boy, I tell you, talk about getting out of the boat. The next Monday evening, there were 10,000 people that gathered at her church, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and prayed together and said, okay, Lord, where do we go now? What's the next step? But she became convicted that this country had something to learn about equality and about justice. And talk about risking, talk about putting yourself on the line, getting out of the boat. I mean, look at the cost of the whole civil rights movement, what's happened in the last 40 years. I say, praise God, we have made some changes in this country. There's been progress, still a lot more to be made. But you compare where we are now versus where we were 40 years ago, and there's a difference. I can even testify to that. I remember growing up as a kid in Texas that we had two drinking fountains. One was marked colored, and the other was marked, you know, for white people. You didn't even drink at the same drinking fountain. We had two sets of bathrooms, you know. There was a colored, and there was a, okay. It's incredible. As I was thinking about this week, I just started to cry. You know, just the feelings of how awful we can be to each other, you know, as fellow human beings on the same planet. My point is, here's an individual who looked at the Lord and said, Lord, what do you want me to do? What does it mean to be a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ? I want to get out of the boat. I want to do something. And she did it. And the results have absolutely been incredible. But it's a decision. It's a decision. It's a choice. You don't just drift into it. And another thing that has come to me as I've done this study on this text is I've noticed something I really don't like, and that is that the fear factor is there again and again and again and again. Now, I still believe, probably, that water skiing, when you get good enough, it isn't so fearful. But when it comes to what we're talking about here today, it is repeated again and again and again, even in our story. Jesus made the disciples get in the boat and go ahead of him, and they do, and a storm comes up, and they are afraid. 3 to 6 o'clock in the morning, Jesus comes walking on the water, and they're terrified. Jesus says, take courage, it's I, don't be afraid. So Peter asks for some confirmations, says, Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water, and he does, and there's more fear. Lord, save me. And I want to tell you something. If you know anything about Peter, this isn't the last time that he's terrified. I mean, it's going to happen again and again and again. To be a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ means that you are a learner, you are a student, and you are making a choice consciously, daily, to grow and to leave the comfort zone of your boat that is comfortable, the circumstances that you've grown accustomed to, where you know how to operate and to go out there and to risk, to get out of the boat, to leave your established comfort zones. And every time you do that, you experience fear. I do. And this fear will never go away for a follower of Jesus Christ. That's why I've entitled this A Fear-Filled Faith. Every time you get out of the boat, fear goes up. Discipleship is always a choice between comfort and fear. Comfort and fear. Boy, that's bad news. Because if there's anything I want, it's comfort. We have a whole society now that is into comfort, don't we? I asked somebody the other day, what are they going to do for the weekend? They said, nothing. And the way they said that, I knew they meant nothing. I had the sense that the food was going to be brought to them and put through a tube. I mean, literally, nothing. You know, we have a phrase for this. I mean, it's like veg out, right? I mean, we are going to absolutely do nothing. We are into comfort. And we even have a special name for people who come home from a hard day of work and just sit there, usually in front of the television. We call them what?
Couch potatoes.
Yeah, couch potatoes. And you know, that's a far cry from discipleship, isn't it? From getting out of the boat. Total opposite. Now, 11 disciples, the 11 other disciples, I would like to call them boat potatoes. They stayed in their comfort zone. They didn't want to run the risks. They chose comfort instead of fear. Now, churches are full, and pardon me if I get too close to you at this moment, of pew potatoes. Now, fortunately, we don't have pews here, so you don't have to take it absolutely personally, but you know what I mean. Religious faith for many church members is a matter of spiritual padding. just making life a little more tolerable, a little more comfortable, adding some comfort to life. And we want to have a nice boat that is really comfortable, and we want the air conditioning right and the heating and the carpet and everything right, and we want to be comfortable there. And you know, you may not have been out of the boat for a long time. Perhaps you can remember a time when you stepped out of the boat, your religious boat, I say, and you said to the Lord, okay, Jesus, whatever you want me to do, I'll do, whatever it is. But maybe you've grown comfortable and it's been a long time since you've stepped out of the boat, and you may be afraid to step out of the boat right now. I know about that feeling. I do. This week I was reflecting on the fact that 10 years ago, almost to the day, I sat down at the desk at the Encinitas Church where Ed used to do his counseling. It was a metal desk when I walked into there 10 years ago to get, just practically this day. And I remember having to fight back the tears. Not because I didn't want to be there. I did. I'd asked for this assignment. But because I was scared. It was a departure for me. It was getting out of the boat. I felt vulnerable. I felt exposed. Here I was. I was sitting here, and all of a sudden, just absolutely scared. I mean, I'd come from a church with kind of a built-in protection layers where everything is going to happen. You know, there's no way to have any big, really bad disasters, right? Because you have this big staff, and you have secretaries, and you have offices, and you have everything running smoothly, and you have 2,000, 3,000 members, and you've got all the college students, and people are going to show up for services, no question about that. You know, I mean, and it felt safe, and I got into this situation, and I realized there were only 23 of us here. There were no children. There were no Sabbath schools, and I was wanting to start a church that was different than what we had used to been doing, and I'll tell you, I remember still just fighting back the tears and saying, Lord, this absolutely petrifies me. It petrifies me. And you think, well, that was 10 years ago. Well, how about this week? You know, I'm still facing situations right now that absolutely have driven me to my knees. I woke up at 2:00 this morning, couldn't sleep, had to sit down and write some things on a pad to the Lord because of fear. And I think, what is this? What are you afraid of, Jerry? And the best thing I've been able to come up with as I analyze is I'm afraid of looking unsuccessful to people that really matter to me. You know, a few weeks ago I was worshiping at one of the big churches in Loma Linda, and the pipe organ was playing, and the elders were elding, and the deacons were deeking, and the thing was kind of flowing, and I thought, my goodness, you know, and there were 1,000 people there, and I thought back, wow, this feels so comfortable. It feels so safe. This feels so safe. What we're doing here feels so scary, you know, in contrast. That do you know what I'm saying? What is it we're afraid of? What is it we're afraid of? Boy, Lord, help me some way to give up this obsession with appearing successful. And being willing to run that risk, not just once, but every day, of stepping out of the boat. Stepping out of the boat. Sometimes I've discovered I want to walk on the water just to impress the boat people. Yeah. And I suppose Peter had that problem too. You know, he might have gotten out there and taken the first 3 steps and then looked back at the guy and said, whoa! Are you guys seeing this? This is pretty incredible, isn't it? You better write this up for the union paper. We need a little publicity on this. This is incredible what I'm doing. Nobody else has ever done this before. Our church is unique, right? Oh, my goodness. Walking on water isn't about impressing boat people. It's about coming to Jesus. And if you try it, you may sink. But you know what? That's okay. Matthew 14, verse number 31. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and he caught him. You of little faith, he said, why did you doubt? And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. And then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. When people get out of the boat and start to sink, they discover that Jesus is able to save. And when that happens, people worship God. When lives are being changed and people are being lifted right out of the waves, other people worship God. Yeah, even the people in the boat worship God. Wow. I want to tell you about a man by the name of Bob. Insurance salesman, no Christian background at all, an example of what we're talking about in our mission statement, turning non-Christian people into fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. He didn't even know what it meant to pray. And Doug, who was discipling him, tried to explain to him about prayer and said, prayer, God is just waiting to respond and to talk to you when you talk to him, and he will respond. I mean, and Doug, who was discipling him, quoted in the text, ask whatsoever you will in my name, it'll be yours. And his new Christian, Bob, said, that sounds absolutely incredible. What does that mean? I mean, I just can't quite fathom that. Whatever, whatever. You have to use common sense. Yeah, doesn't mean that you're going to be now the dictator of the universe. You know, we take that text that says, you know, you can have this mountain move and this mountain move. Come on, get real. It doesn't mean that all the geography is now going to become subservient to everybody's whimsical prayers, and those mountains are going to start dancing around every 3 minutes because of who prayed the last prayer as to where the Himalayas are going to be located. I mean, that's not what that's really talking about. But it does mean that the power of the Almighty God is available at our disposal and is wanting to use us. And apparently, this little experience, the person who was discipling Bob, well, he did something that maybe I wouldn't have done, maybe you wouldn't have done, but he said to him, I want to show you how this works. He said, I want you to pray a specific prayer for a month. And so he said, what do you want to pray about? He says, well, I want to pray for a particular country in Africa. It's in great turmoil, great need right now. Okay, you pray that prayer for a month, and if at the end of the month nothing has happened, I'll give you $500. If, on the other hand, at the end of the month, you've seen the miracle-working power of God as a result of your prayers and something has happened, you give me $500. And if you don't pray every day and don't pray regularly for this, all bets are off. Now, that's an unusual way to disciple people. But anyway, you know, it has a point. I mean, it's called putting your money where your mouth is, I guess. But anyway, so they decided to go ahead with it, and he began to pray day after day for this particular country in Africa, and toward the end of the month, nothing had happened. And all of a sudden, one day, he found himself at a testimonial dinner of some kind, and he was seated at a table at this dinner with people that he didn't know, and he was getting acquainted with the other people at the table and discovered that, lo and behold, there was a lady seated at his table who was from a hospital orphanage in the very country that he'd been praying about, in Africa. So he pricked up his ears and started quizzing her about that country and started pumping her with questions. And she said, well, how come you're so interested in this place? And so he told her about his rather unusual arrangement, you know, the $500 and this prayer and this month. And she said, well, would you like to come and to visit our country and to see what we're doing with these folks? And Bob said, yes. And so he flew there and he toured the facility. And boy, third world country, you know what things are like in Africa? Desperate. The news, it's absolutely incredible, isn't it? I mean, I have no comprehension of the loss of life that's going on right now. You know, I mean, in these countries right now, this week, I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of people getting just slaughtered. We have no comprehension of it. Well, he went there and he discovered the abject need and the total poverty of the country, and he came back and he determined he needed to do something. So he started making some contacts with people he knew in the pharmaceutical business. And he ended up raising over $1 million worth of pharmaceutical products and shipping them to that country, and particularly to that hospital, orphanage. And so they naturally appreciated it. And the lady from that orphanage contacted him and said, hey, we're going to have a big celebration. Would you like to come again and to join in the celebration? And he did, and he met the president of the country. I mean, it's a very small country, and this happens to be the biggest hospital in the country. And so the president of the country was very grateful to him for what he had done in helping this particular institution, and took him on a tour, said, meet me in the capital city and we'll go in my limousine and we'll tour around the capital. And so Bob did. And as they were touring around, he and the president of the country, they drove by a prison. And Bob said, what's that? And the president of the country said, it's a prison. Well, who do you keep in there? Political prisoners. What's political prisoners? You know, just people that, you know, political prisoners. And Bob said to the president of the country, you shouldn't do that. It's not a good idea. They finished the tour, and Bob flew back to the United States. And a few days later, he got a phone call, 2 o'clock in the morning. State Department, United States government. The official said from the State Department, were you recently in such and such a country? And he named the country that Bob had just visited. And Bob said, yes. He said, did you say something to the president of that country about political prisoners? Bob said, yes, that he had. Well, I don't know what you said, but they've just all been released. We've been trying at the State Department for years to get those prisoners released, and now they've been released. What'd you say? Bob said, well, I told him it was a bad idea. When people get out of the boat, amazing things happen. Amazing things happen. Things that committees and institutions would take lifetimes to accomplish can be done in a moment with the power of God working through people that get out of the boat and make a commitment to Jesus Christ. Can you imagine? I was just dreaming this week of the power that would be unleashed in this room and in this church and in this part of California if everybody here today would just simply say, Lord, I'm going to get out of the boat. I am going to get out of the boat. I'm going to take that step. I'm going to move out of my comfort zone, and I am fully available. I am yours. Use me. Whatever. Whatever you want me to do. I think Jesus is still looking for people to get out of the boat. And if you do, you're going to face problems because there's a storm out there. Amen? There is a storm out there. You know it every day. Your faith will not be perfect, and there will be times when you go, you will sink. But I know two other things, and that is that when you do sink, and you will, Jesus will be there to pick you up. He will not leave you alone. And I also know that every once in a while, you're going to walk on the water. Dear Lord, fill us with that kind of a spirit as we now look at putting into practice the 7-step strategy that we've been studying now for 2 months. Lord, may we, the church, determine to be fully devoted followers of you ourselves, so that you can use us in ministry to do whatever you want to accomplish, Lord. Empower our Stephen Ministry leaders and the ones who are leading out in the classes, and may more be able to go to those classes this summer. I just pray that many, many people in this fellowship will become trained to know how to serve and to minister as they step out of the boat. Give us the courage to leave our comfort zones and to be willing to face fear, to make that deliberate choice. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.